Hello, good morning, and a very warm welcome to the Phoenix Park this morning for the Bord Bia annual Bloom Festival of Horticulture and Food. There are two things going on here this morning. Gliding across the surface of the Phoenix Park is an elegant mix of show gardens, trade stands, food stalls, and people giving their Panama hats there. One day of the year outing. That's the Bloom that you know. The Bloom that you might not be as familiar with is paddling unseen beneath the surface. There's a frenzy of commercial activity as food producers strike deals with retailers. We're going to be getting a little bit of a glimpse into that later on. One of the really nice things I think about Bloom as a visitor is the chats. You get to have chats with experts in just about everything, as I did yesterday. Chats with people who are expert in making handcrafted axes, in making shish kebabs, and every potted plant ever grown.
Bob, there's factor 50 there, don't forget to put it on you.
That's good advice about the factor.
Absolutely.
50,
would
isn't
you like
it?
Me to apply some? We have factor 50, 30 and 15.
Do you know what?
What?
Could I have a dab of 50 for my nose?
Would you like a dab of 50?
Would you mind?
I would not. I'll let you dab yourself.
Oh my God.
And
you are the queen of sunscreens.
Oh no, you're out in it all the time.
Every single option under the sun
there. Every option under the sun. But that's actually a very good one.
What has it taken to get to this stage of readiness for you guys? Because, my God, this is some display of flowers.
Once we finish Bloom, we start for next year.
Next week we'll start preparing for next
week
Bloom.
We start for next. We see what's selling, what's not selling, what's good, what's not good.
And what do you expect to be your best seller?
Salvias.
Show me.
Yeah, all of these. We do 13 varieties of salvias. They're just wonderful. They flower the whole summer long. Bee and butterfly, really friendly, scented. Smell that. Don't put your nose in it because it'll stick to it.
But you know what I was just thinking?
Smell that.
Because I've just put sunscreen all over my nose, I now can't smell anything, only sunscreen.
No, you will smell that.
Oh,
that no.
Nice. No. Oh, suits you.
Isn't it gorgeous? And amazing red flowers.
It is a beautiful looking piece. Now, what is involved in making that?
So I'll get that block of steel and I'll use certain machines to heat it up and to squish it into shape and punch holes and drift my hole, and then I'll sharpen it and heat treat it, which hardens the material.
How many hours of work with that?
In the labour for the ironwork in the head, there's about 2 days of work. The day forging and...
Are you kidding me, really?
Yeah, well, when you get good at it, that's what it dials down to. When you've got your tooling made up and things like that, you could probably make the head in a day and then another day for finishing and sharpening and then another day for your handle.
So what does it do to you when you see people walking into Woody's and coming out with something prefabricated from China?
These tools, when they were first designed and made, let's say I started my apprenticeship as a carpenter, I would buy it and then I would pass it down to my son, he'd pass it down to his son. Nowadays, we don't have that kind of same respect for tools or objects. We're very disposable.
Haven't you started very early?
Yeah.
Shish kebab at 9:30 in the morning.
People like it, that, you know.
Do they?
People really, yeah, people like this. People, they're having the naan bread, biryanis and all that, you know.
And how many people come to the restaurant saying, I had your buttered chicken at Bloom
so
and that's
people.
Why I'm here?
So many people. So many people here. So many, they say it. It's really, I had the butter chicken there. They said, I had a shish kebab there, you know. So many people coming. Biryani. And the people, I can eat biryani there in Bloom. Can you make like that biryanis, you know, like in the restaurants? It's good. And it's good, you know, they get regular customers and all that, you know.
Isn't it? That's exactly what.
Can I be very rude and intrude and ask what amazing discoveries you've made? Because you seem very excited about it.
Well, we've just discovered the Siberian bugloss here.
Why is that interesting?
Because I pull it out of my garden all the time. Now I realise the things I've been pulling out of my garden, I should be leaving them there.
What is a weed? What is a flower? This is not a botanical question. This is a philosophical
it
question.
It is indeed. It is indeed. And that's the philosophical discussion for today, isn't it?
It is. So show it to me, please.
So this one here.
This pretty
see that
little blue one.
Blue flowers.
With the blue, but look at the leaf. What do you see?
Why would you pull that out of your garden?
Well, because it's invasive. It's going everywhere.
It was lovely. You was monster. You
completely
monster.
In fact, I've seen them. I've seen several things in these gardens here now that I've been pulling out. Buttercups. I feel like a murderer now.
Hand yourself into the Hague War Crimes Tribunal
completely.
Now.
Completely. Jokes apart, I mean, I have looked at things now and thought maybe taking a different attitude to your garden, not being so wanting it to look so twee and being prepared to let it be a little bit more natural. But that would probably be the takeaway I'll take from today, I think.
That's the trend. That's the way everything is
it
moving,
is,
really,
it
isn't
is.
It? We've got to stop manicuring the life out of our garden.
Instead of taming nature, go with nature.
Well, I am at the Walled Garden here in Bloom, in the space between the show gardens and the food stands. That's RTE all over, isn't it? Stuck in that space between beauty and nutrition. So we've had to bring the nutrition and bring the food to us, bring the food here. We're going to talk sauces, we're going to talk jams, we're going to talk porridge. Let's start with sauces and Tom Carney from Insanely Good. Congratulations, first off, Tom, on the name. Who came up with that?
Good morning, Philip. Myself and my partner, Dennis, travelling the long road one evening, came up with the idea of Insanely Good.
And the name?
Yeah. Yeah, as we travelled along the long road from up and down the country, we were trying to bring a retail brand to the market. So we said, how would we do it? So we looked at Ben and Jerry's and we said, let's bring some fun to this thing and have a bit of crack with it. So that's what we did.
What do you make?
From the Insanely Good ranges, it's typically all sauces. So cooking sauces, pour-over sauces, condiment sauces. So when we speak to that, pepper sauce is our signature in the Insanely Good range. It's hugely popular.
Now, people are very dismissive of sauces from jars and sauces from packets, but I had a little taste of your katsu earlier on. And I'm going to do it again now, because what have you managed to do there? What alchemy have you performed?
Well, it's just, the magic that we do is we hunt flavour. So we have a strict view at home that everyone has everything in his life, except the only thing that changes is what's on in the evening. So it's our responsibility to give you something that you remember.
Okay.
So it will not, if it's not insanely good, it's not going on that bottle.
But what is really clever about this is that there are three different things going on in my mouth at the moment, and they're going on and on.
And that is the secret to joy. That is food. You have to have that in the end of the day. So we build our flavours. We are experts at what we do in flavour terms, through blending of spices, in terms of the katsu, a lovely bit of coconut, nice bit of heat, depth of spice, to give you what you're describing.
How come you ended up doing sauces when you're from a dairy background?
Well, I'm from a dairy background, but I went and studied food science in UCC. And then I went from there and I studied spice technology in the States. And then I brought it all home.
Spice technology?
Yeah, I was
Is that a degree course?
No, but I was very fortunate to be trained by a PhD, you say a degree course. The man that trained me, Frank Delafera, had a PhD in spice technology.
So it's a doctorate level kind of thing.
Yeah.
Talk to me about the business end of this. I made reference to it there a few minutes ago, that everybody knows the food stalls and the show gardens and so on, but there is an insane amount of business going on here, particularly on the Friday.
Totally. This is probably one of the best opportunities of the year to meet and get opportunity to sell to all the retailers, food service, everything. This is saves us an inordinate amount of time every year that we come and meet people rather than driving from deep down in West Cork all the way to Dublin every second week. We come and we meet and we solve problems and we gain business.
And there's real business done here. Deals and contracts are signed and negotiated here.
I wouldn't go that far, but I would say they're great openers and great closers and great problem-solving places. Very quickly, decisions can be taken.
Can you afford to not be here?
We take a bit of fun out of it because a great day for the team to come here, a great weekend for the team to come here. It's a cost, but it's a wonderful experience,
but
and you're meeting the punters.
What I'm saying to you is that you're already listed in Musgraves and Tesco's and Dunn's, aren't you? So, you know, what advantage is it to you to be here?
Our huge advantage is meeting the people, getting the experience, getting the joy of what you hadn't tasted in the katsu, and getting it in a big level and getting people talking about the little brand.
And what I'm still tasting in the katsu, which is a pity because I'm about to go and put jam in on top of that. Felix Oster from More Taste. You're a man who successfully turned a personal virtue into a business, making, not sugar-free, but very low-sugar jam, and successfully making it a business. risky thing, though, isn't it? Taking a personal taste and saying, yeah, I'm going to take a punt on this and make it a business.
Yeah, that's right. Good morning, Philip. So I've been making the products probably for around 10 years, I would say. And the reason why I started was that I was told by my doctor to reduce my sugar intake. And I tried to find jams and chocolate spreads that are better, so that have a really high natural fruit content, mm-hmm. and trying to maximize the fruit and really minimizing the sugar content. Okay.
So blueberry jam, I'm about to have a little taste. Normally, when you make a jam, it's 50% sugar or thereabouts, isn't it? How much sugar is there in that?
That's just 20% sugar. So it's a reduction of around 60%.
But it is bursting with blueberry flavor. The tricky thing for you, though, must be, where do you get the blueberries with flavor? Because at this time of year, so many of the blueberries that are still being imported, they're already flavorless.
That's right. And one of the main parts of the business is sourcing the right ingredients. Because I like using that much real fruit, I can't use fruit that doesn't taste. Mm. So getting the fruit is the big secret, and specifically the type of the fruit using as well. For the blueberry jam, I only use wild blueberries that have a different taste profile and that are more intense, really? And that really make that intense fruit flavor in the
jam. We originally put sugar into jam to preserve it throughout the year. So do you lose shelf life by not having as much sugar in there?
So as long as it's closed, it would be preserved. There's no problem at all.
Of course, of course. But once you've opened it?
Once you opened it, it wouldn't last for like 6 months. It would last for around 4 to 6 weeks. But that's the reason why the jar is a little bit smaller, to make you go through a full jar that stays in your fridge.
Okay.
Without going bad, really.
Now, those are the healthy ones. You have a chocolate and hazelnut spread as well. I presume that this is just pure indulgence, is it?
That's exactly what I'm trying to do. That's a brand new product that's just introduced to the public here at Bloom this year. And again, what I'm trying to do is...
I shouldn't be having chocolate at this hour of the morning, but that is gorgeous. Oh.
So I don't think you need that much sugar in a chocolate spread. What you want to have is that intense taste of hazelnuts and chocolate, really.
Oh, it's there. The hazelnuts are there. But where are you finding hazelnuts? I mean, obviously native to this country, but not grown abundantly.
No, but I was told that it might change. So I know that there are some farmers starting to grow hazelnuts. There's not enough yet for me to really use them. So at the moment, that would be Italian hazelnuts. Okay. So the Italian hazelnuts have a really nice taste profile.
So calling all hazelnut producers on the island of Ireland, contact Felix Oster. How many years are you here now? Because I'm marvelling at your confidence in punning in Irish. it's M. O'Fada or more taste. Mm. That was a brave step.
It was, yes. So as you probably here. I'm not from Ireland originally. I'm from Germany. I've been living in Ireland for around 5 years, but the products are produced here in Ireland, and I want to make clear to consumers and shoppers that the products are Irish. They're supposed to be Irish. And even if I'm not Irish, I thought that the brand really highlights both like the difference in taste, but also the heritage of the product.
Indeed, indeed. John Lawler from Kilbega Notes. Good morning to you. How are you?
Good morning, Philip. I'm good, thank you.
Between yourself and your dad, you're growing the oats and then you're running the food business as well in a company of three people. There's not much scope for anybody going sick there, is there?
No, we're very busy. Young children at home, and yeah, it certainly keeps you moving all the time. And you have to be trying to do a bit of everything all the time. We're not particularly good at anything other than growing organic oats. But with them, we've managed to learn how to do all the other bits in between.
You're not just growing organic oats. You're growing organic oats on a farm that went organic 22 years ago, was it?
Yeah, so we started our conversion journey in 1999. So 2001, we would have been fully organic. And we farmed away organically for a while. And then it was in 2010, 2011, we decided we think we're doing a good job growing oats. So we would like to
test them out with the consumers. So we got a small bit milled and from there it took off.
Is there a nature dividend on the farm a quarter of a century on in that journey?
We absolutely feel that there is. We feel like the bird life, the animal life, the insect life is where you really see it in organics. We're in a cluster of organic farms, so our neighbours either side of us are also organic. You'll find that one farmer takes the leap, next you have another farmer will see he's not actually insane, and then you'll have a cluster of farms, so you will. And especially when you get enough organic acreage together, there's good research to show that you get a good nature dividend and a good payoff because the insects are vibrant and then the birds are around and it's okay. Just a food chain.
I'm not going to taste your product on air because I have already tasted it, and it is the crack cocaine or the methamphetamine of cookies. How did you do that?
Exactly. So we have two products. We have our porridge oats, which is your healthy option.
Which everybody knows.
Slightly less healthy option, which are our oat cookies. The secret with the cookies is our organic oats and then Irish butter. You just really can't beat Irish butter. There's no oils in it or anything like that. And the flavour, we don't need as much sugar in them because the flavour comes through from the butter and the oats.
Okay. Gentlemen, thank you all very much for joining us this morning. John, Felix, Tom. Where were you 20 years ago in 2004, people? I know Tom and his wife had just welcomed their firstborn, Fionn, into the world. And Fionn is working on the insanely good stand here at Bloom this weekend. John was studying physiotherapy, of all things, not growing oats. And Felix had just moved to London to learn English, where he met his wife, Simona, working at a pretzel counter in Selfridges. There's another story we're going to have to get you back to tell some other day. But 20 years ago, a young man called Declan O'Rourke was in a recording studio in Dublin laying down the very first track on his very first album. That album is Since Kyabram. That track is One Way Minds. And this morning, ladies and gentlemen, is Declan O'Rourke joining us live here in the Phoenix Park to remind us 20 years on what an insanely good song this is.
Hey girl, I've seen you looking at me. Am I the one that you want? The one you wanna set free? Oh, just follow the lines and you can go anywhere with two one-way minds. You can go anywhere with two one-way minds. Whoa, just follow the lines and you can go anywhere with two one-way minds. Whoa.
There is no way that song is 20 years old. Chat with Declan O'Rourke in a little while. Right now, I want to take an ad break.
Email countrywide@rte.ie. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
So we were just listening to what Declan O'Rourke was doing 20 years ago. Judith and Hugh, what happened here 5 years ago at Bloom and Phoenix Park?
We met. I was sitting in.
You didn't know each other?
Not at all. Randomly sat down with a coffee at a table, and there was a beautiful woman there. We started chatting, and she offered me some of her apple cake.
Apple cake was the root to this man's heart, it would seem.
It was indeed.
And how long after that did you get married?
No, we haven't gotten married yet.
You haven't got married? No. You're living in sin. I'm sorry, I can't talk to you any longer.
We're just practicing. Got to get it right.
And you're here for business as well, anyway.
My dad is in his 80s. He's Cassidy Copper Creations. He's a stand over beyond on the Green Avenue there. So he's in his 80s, hand makes copper work, so we're there today to support him
and
with that.
You're celebrating an anniversary of sorts.
Oh, yes. As we were, yeah.
Five years.
Congratulations to both of you. Thanks very much for stopping and talking. Okay. You may have heard a little bit earlier on, I was speaking to a woman who was visiting Bloom, saying that we all need to look at our gardens a little differently and allow that space for nature to come in. This is certainly something of a trend that we're seeing here at Bloom this year. I'm joined by the gold medal winning designer, Leonie Cornelius, who won Best Small Garden Award for her balcony garden called Or, sponsored by Zarbi's. Silver medal winning designer, Nora Tomba, whose garden is called Rewild, and Catherine Cleary from Pocket Forest, whose postcard garden is also called Pocket Forest and was highly commended by the judges. Leonie, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Is it important to you when you design a garden that we should feel like we're in nature and not in another room that just happens to have a few plants in it?
Absolutely, 100%. I think gardens are a real chance to create something for ourselves where we actually share the space with nature. So they're a chance for me as a garden designer to create something that really immerses you in nature and you can kind of cohabit with wildlife. And by becoming aware of it, you really start to nurture and feel responsible for it. So okay. It's a really beautiful chance, yeah.
We don't have the benefit of it having your balcony garden here in front of us, so tell me about it.
Ooh, so it's a very small space, 5 by 2 meters. It has a very comfortable seat in it. It's got three kind of areas. It's very open to one side, then it becomes more enclosed with a pergola, and then you've got this really comfortable seat in the corner where you're enclosed by a massive pine.
And it smells.
It does.
It reeks, but it's gorgeous.
Lots of Mediterranean scents, so lavender, very drought tolerant planting. And it just, the idea was to slow people down and let them discover little details.
And edimentals, a term that people might not be familiar with, but I'm sure there are plenty of people who already have edimentals growing in their garden.
Mm, without knowing it, exactly. So a small garden, obviously, a lot of plants need to multitask. So you can have things in there that double up. So edibles, which are ornamental. So plants that you can eat, use in the kitchen, and that also look beautiful.
Like
herbs, lavender. There's even cabbages you can use that look amazing. You know, all sorts of little touches that are edible. Teas, sages, you know, thyme, and they all look very, very beautiful.
Now, the bees were working the hell out of your garden this morning when I went down to it. But look, let's not kid ourselves. One balcony garden is not going to tip the scales in biodiversity's favour. But it does start winning hearts and minds, doesn't it? People's attitudes.
I think it's about awareness. I think it really is about, you know, slowing down, seeing the small things. And when you see a bee go to a flower and interact with it, and you know, you become aware of it yourself, and then you want to nurture it. And I think it's all about that, creating awareness so that that spreads.
You can't save what you don't appreciate. Nora Tomba, Rewild is a word which at my last count I think had about 14 different definitions. What does rewild mean to you?
Rewild to me means, rewild can be understand in different scales, and it can be different in a small garden as opposed to in a larger landscape. In my definition, rewild is giving back to nature to a capacity that you can, and you can still enjoy nature in the meanwhile. For example, my garden rewild at the festival, it allows also for ornamental plants to grow next to native plants, and it's still beneficial to nature and nurturing nature while also nurturing your soul while having your favorite plants in your garden.
And it's a little bit more rough around the edges. It's not for a small garden perfectly manicured. That's by design.
Exactly. So my garden starts with a monocultural lawn space in the front, which I wanted to show contrast as you moving deeper into the space, into a more lush and diverse and tranquil space that is nurturing both your soul and nature and wildlife.
And you won a silver.
I won a silver gold medal here, yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much,
well,
Philip.
Catherine Cleary, we're very faddish, fashionable creatures, us human beings. Mm-hmm. Do you think that this, what we've just been talking about here, letting things get a little bit rougher around the edges, might just be the 2024 fashion and that we'll have moved on to something by 2025, something else?
Philip, let's hope not. I mean, it has been the fashion for 11,000 years, really, if we think back to what the land looked like before we started to manage it, I suppose, and before we influenced it in such a huge way. So what we do with Pocket Forests is bring native trees and plants back into people's lives, I suppose, into their gardens, into their communities, just showing how easy it is. These plants belong here, they thrive, they don't need a lot of expertise. They just need the right soil conditions. It's lovely to hear Nora talking about nurturing the soil as well as, and soil and soul are very closely related words, I think. So, yeah, I think you could say, oh, well, the rewild thing is a trend, it's a fad, but it's got deeper roots than that. I think it's people, we've had such great conversations here with people at Bloom at our Pocket Forest postcard garden. People are just saying, you know, if my garden was like this, I'd feel like I was in heaven. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't know how deeply connected we are to that sense of plants thriving and being in the right place and doing the right thing and interacting with everything around them, including us.
You've evolved the Pocket Forests idea from seeking to plant trees in communal spaces to say, well, you know what, we should actually encourage people to do this in their gardens.
Yeah, I mean, we work mainly with communities. Ash, my colleague, Ash Conrad-Jones and Amy, we work mainly with communities, so with schools and residence groups. We work in hospices with the GAA. But what we'd love to see is people doing this themselves, because obviously there's only so many of these we can do, and if we can get more people doing it themselves, giving them the skills and the ideas and how to do it and how to manage trees and shrubs, native trees and shrubs in urban areas, that's really our focus. It's really to get urban areas which are so nature depleted, and it's having huge effects on people's well-being, I think, to be so disconnected from natural environments.
Very quickly, tell me, if I do go and get a Pocket Forest tree pack, what can I expect in it?
Yeah, you can go to our website and register. So we're just trialing it this year. So the tree pack is going to come with some videos showing you how to prepare your area. Then the tree pack will come at planting time, and then we'll follow up with videos with experts on how to look after your pocket forest in your garden.
Catherine, thank you very much. Nora and Leonie too. Bloom may take place in Dublin over the June bank holiday weekend, but talented gardeners bring their own local stories to the Phoenix Park. Off the top of my head, I have seen here a love letter to Abby Leakes from a garden in Laois. I've seen the Cloak and Oak postcard garden from Mr. Dunn's fifth class in St. Bridget's Primary School in Kildare, who must be thrilled with the distinction that they got from the judges. Amongst the show gardens here is one from the farmers of Rathcrohan in Roscommon. Another silver medal winner. It is called the Rathcrohan Oum Alphabet Garden, and it reflects an archaeologically rich landscape near the village of Tulsk in Roscommon. Ella McSweeney walked the land that inspired this Bloom garden with Gerard Healy to talk about the challenges of farming in such a sensitive landscape.
Yeah, we're just looking out across now. You can see Tulsk there, village down in the hollow there, and you'll be looking out towards Strokestown, Longford direction, and Alphin and Boyle will be over there to our left.
It's a huge view, isn't it?
Yeah, like from they reckon from the mound you could see up to five counties, I think, at least five, yeah.
But that's probably why it's there.
Well, it was, that's it, always, yeah. Built on a height, yeah, for defence and that type of thing, yeah.
If I was standing here 4,000 or 5,000 years ago, Gerard, can you paint the picture of what you'd see? I mean, at the moment, what I can see is just vast fields. You've got that lovely big sky of Roscommon, and you can see far into the distance. But 5,000 years ago, what would be here?
Yeah, it would have been a very different place. I mean, where we're standing here now, it's an ancient road that leads the whole way to the main Rathcrohan Mound, which is to our west over there. There's houses, settlements there as well. They're all national monuments where people lived, obviously. And yeah, it would have been a hive of activity back in the day. It's actually easier to see it from an aerial picture than on the ground. As you say, it's like just bumps. But once you see an aerial view, it kind of takes more shape. Yeah. There's 240 monuments in a very small radius here, which is quite, you know, you're tripping across archaeology. Look, the general consensus is the New Grange of the West, really. Like, it's been preserved kind of as you see it. And I suppose that's testament to the people that farmed it. Rathcrohan is full of, and I think that's the great thing about it, is there's a lot of stories with Rathcrohan. Like, the Brown Bull of Cooley obviously is the big one, and Cave of the Cats, Halloween, and you know, we have the Mucklers up there that was supposed to be the story of the pigs and all that. Look at the boars, but it's full of stories, and I think that adds to the mythology of it, obviously, you know. Okay, I'm just going to give these guys nuts now. We're finishing them maybe in 4 to 6 weeks to be fit for the factory, I suppose.
You've got their attention.
I know, it's very easy. Yeah. Like kids with sweets.
Tell me about your herd.
I suppose we kill maybe up to 50 cattle a year. It's just beef to finishing cattle. Mostly continental Shirleys, maybe some limousines.
Finishing means that you essentially, you're fattening them from what age?
From about a year and a half.
And where would you buy them from?
Just the local marts, I suppose, Roscommon, Castlereagh. We used to be doing suckler here in sheep, but unfortunately due to canning restrictions and that, I don't live on the farm, so, and I work full time, so I suppose this is the my way of keeping farming.
So how often would you come out here?
Oh, I'm here every day, like, yeah. And it's just, look, I love farming, I love the place. It's just one of them things, it's a restriction, obviously, with the archaeology, and it's one of the restrictions of not being able to build a house here.
And for you and the farmers around here, I suppose on the one hand, there must be something fairly magical about the fact you own land that has such national significance. But on the other hand, there's all sorts of limitations on how you can do things here.
Obviously, you said there about restrictions, and there is. Like, we don't have the opportunity of ploughing here. We don't have the opportunity of planting our land. 9 years ago, Daniel Curley, the manager in the visitor centre, decided to, you know, get everybody, all the stakeholders on board. There was myself and a couple other farmers, NUI Galway, Roscommon County Council, the heritage officer. We had the National Monuments. We put a load of people in a room that necessarily wouldn't always agree with each other. And we'd all look into the same field and we'd all see something different. But I think that's the beauty of how it has actually worked. And out of that operational group came the EIP that we got, the 860,000 for the 5-year EIP.
European Innovation Partnership.
Yeah, which was brilliant. And huge positivity for the area. In fairness, the project has been a huge success. And that's down, obviously, with a great operational group, but it's down to the farmers themselves. They bought into it and they done what they had to do. There was never an EIP in Europe based on archaeology. Mm. We were the first ones. And we'd like to be the forefront of going forward of archaeology. Farmers now are seeing the archaeology rather than seeing, well, Jesus, I have this mound in my field and it's a nuisance. Now it's a positive thing to have one in your field.
And you can hear the traffic behind us. You're very near the road. It is essentially the road. If you drive from Dublin to Westport, you drive through here. I am sure people like me have gone through this area a million times without realising the significance of this area.
Yeah, that's the thing. Even on that, we're developing a walking trail here as well. Yeah, there's people like passing the road here and the mound and what's that like, and you know, the car park. It's just, yeah, I know what the car park is, but they don't know the significance of what's behind the car park.
So there is a big story to be told.
There is, and I think, you know, as I said, even Bloom last year, the reception we got off the public from the little postcard garden we had was brilliant. Like, it definitely got people. It was a brilliant showcase, I think, for not just the archaeology but also the farming end of it and the balance between the two, I guess.
Ella with Gerard Healy in the landscape that inspired the garden that you can come and see here at Bloom. Declan O'Rourke, good morning. How are you?
I'm very well, Philip. What a fine morning to be up early and on.
Speaking of places that ended up inspiring careers, lives, and gardens, the album that we're reflecting on now, 20 years on, is about a landscape that had a pretty important intervention in your life.
That's right. We were visiting when I was living in Australia as a much younger being, 13 years of age. On my birthday, actually, we were visiting a town called Kyabram as a family, stayed there for the weekend. And while we were there, we were staying in a house with some other people, and there was a couple of guitars lying around. And I I snuck away and got one of them at some stage.
Had you ever picked up one before?
I'd had them as a child, but nobody ever showed me what to do. You know, mm-hmm. I'd just break the strings and that was it. It'd be gone, you know. But this particular day, anyway, whoever owned the guitar, it was a man called David, and he saw me do it through, like, the crack of an open door. And I was like, oh, God, you know. He walked on, and the next day we were leaving, and we were just getting in the car, and he followed me out. And he said, I think this belongs to you.
And that's where it started.
That's where it started. And he showed me two chords before I left.
Brilliant. And brilliant.
That was, yeah.
Why revisit this album now? Is it out of affection for the music, or did you feel the need to tinker and meddle and do something different with it?
Oh, it's absolute affection. And, you know, what's the point in rushing through life if we don't stop and appreciate the nice things that have happened? And I have such nostalgia, not only for the album, but the time in my life right then when it happened and everything I was part of.
Are you trying to relive your youth?
No, not at all. But is it gone? But I also was sitting on the master tapes for years, and I wasn't sure what was in there. And given, I suppose, the significance of the number coming up, I said, you know what, I have to have a look in there. And I was astounded at what there was.
But there was a whole load of chats between
lots
tapes.
Of chats between the musicians, because we recorded it live. It was made in 5 days. And it was, you know, I had no concept at that time. Okay. That this
Are you going to do anything with those chats?
Oh, yeah.
Was it an entirely comfortable experience revisiting the 20-year younger version of yourself?
It really was, yeah. It's just for me personally, I just loved looking at it from afar and saying, how did this happen, you know? Mm-hmm. But there's so many funny and lovely moments captured, you know.
But there was obviously some kind of special alchemy going on in the studio.
I think so.
When you listen back to it, are you able to identify what happened? Can you bottle it? Can you sell it? Is there a formula? Is there an algorithm?
Well, it became the yardstick for me. Not the yardstick only, but the template of how to do it. And it was almost accidental at the time. Not accidental. I realised, looking back in the past, I thought I didn't know what I was doing, but I knew more than I thought. If that mm-hmm. makes sense. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's a lovely, refreshing thing to look back and say, I can learn from my younger self, you know, and actually the innocence of that was very powerful, I think. And that's youth in many ways, isn't it?
Start tuning up there, will you?
Yeah.
Tell me, before we get into the next song, that line, the refrain from One Way Minds, what inspired that? Where did you get that line from?
You can go anywhere with two one-way minds. Yeah. Is that it? I don't remember.
I don't remember. I should have made sure that you were going to have a better answer to that question before I asked it. So let me just remind our listeners that you're, because I would obviously might not get anywhere asking you where your gigs are. So I'll tell people where your gigs are while you tune up. Munro's in Galway is part of the Galway Folk Festival on Wednesday, the 5th of June. Tickets available for your live dates in Cork Opera House. October, though, October 19th.
These are the three you're mentioning now are specifically around the Kai Abram whole thing and the re-release, which is,
Vicar Street, October 27th, and Belfast on November 10th as well.
Indeed.
Revisiting this brilliant album, lovely album, 20 years on. You're going to play us out with Galileo.
I'm very lucky, yes. Thank you so much, Philip.
No, thank you very much, Declan. And good morning from the Phoenix Park.
Galileo fell in love as a Galilean boy, and he wondered what in heavens, who invented such a joy. But the question got the better of his scientific mind, and to his blind and dying days, He looked up high and often sighed and thanked the guy who puts the rainbow in the sky. Who lights the stars at night? Who dreamt up someone so divine? Someone like you and made them. Someone like you and made them.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.